Welcome to the Scuffed Podcast. I'm Adam Bells in Georgia. With me is Greg Velasquez in Iowa. We talk about U.S. men's soccer. We thought it'd be worthwhile to do a little refresher on World Cup qualifying so far, both for people newly paying attention and for those who have been paying attention and may have forgotten a bit of what's transpired. Over the next 2 weeks, the episodes will come faster and thicker, but before that all starts, let's recap how we got where we are and try to come up with some insight. I'll leave that mostly to you, Greg. How you doing?
Good. Bells, it's been a journey, hasn't it, going into this final window?
It sure has. And, you know, I went back and watched a lot of the – basically watched all the shots for both teams.
That's the way to do it.
For every window except the most recent one. The most recent one is fresh enough in my mind. I didn't need that refresher. And, you know, I don't know if I have anything super new to say, but I think it was useful for me to go back and look at it. And I think it'll be useful for most people to hear us go back through it. You know, useful, I use that in a very loose sense.
Well, let's also start out by saying where we are now, what the picture looks like now, before we get into the time machine. Cause I think that's important too. And then I totally agree. Like having the sort of the benefit of that time going by and not being as much of like a prisoner of the immediate reaction or even like the one window reaction is useful because it is kind of like ephemeral, right? Like that, the emotions you had at that point, even if you can kind of put yourself back in that place, you're like, oh yeah, this feels different watching it from afar.
Yeah. And I'm not, you know, I'm ready. I'm coming at this with a posture of learning, like talking about it out loud is going to help me sort of think it through more than just, going through it, I guess. We should talk about where we are, right?
We are joint second. Yeah, we're tied for second in the CONCACAF region, the eight-team region, the Ocho, this cycle. The top three teams qualify automatically. Canada in first with 25 points. The U.S. and Mexico both on 21 points. Crucially, the U.S. traveling to Mexico for their next match. Panama in fourth, so on the heels of the auto qualification spot with 17 points, and then Costa Rica still very much alive in fifth with 16 points.
And it's really been, you know, our chief nemesis basically since the first window has been Panama. Like we don't need to beat Mexico in the standings. We do need to beat Panama if we want to be top three. And if we happen to beat Mexico, that's fine too.
And Costa Rica, like that's still the scenario that I'm like somehow most worried about. Is Costa Rica turning it on in the last window using their wily veteran guile sneak like an outrageous 9-point window and get ahead of us even if we win our home match against Panama?
It'd be a legend for them to do that against Canada at home, against us at home. Who do they have in the middle?
I want to say it's like Honduras. It's a very winnable game for them in the middle. A very winnable away game as away games go.
Yeah. As we know, no away game is
El Salvador. Sorry, they're playing at El Salvador on their middle match.
So, you know, they could end up with 3 points from beating us in the last game. You know, I mean, anything is possible, really. But yeah, I guess that 9-point window is within striking distance. I think of when you say Wiley Costa Rica, I think of Brian Ruiz's goal in that against Panama and just that sort of the way they scratched out that result.
Well, and they tied Mexico in Mexico City. I know we're already talking just more about the current picture of things, but to go way back in the Wayback Machine, I think of them in the last couple of cycles, how they got out of what they turned into a group of death in the World Cup with Uruguay, England, and Italy. Uruguay and Costa Rica get out of the group and send England and Italy packing.
Never underestimate the Ticos.
Exactly.
So we have Mexico on the road, Panama at home in Orlando, and then Costa Rica on the road. And really, we just need to beat Panama. I mean, almost certainly just beating Panama will qualify us in the top three. It's not, I mean, with all due respect to your 9-point window fears about Costa Rica, I think that is pretty unlikely. So we just got to beat Panama. But again, I think it's worthwhile to kind of look back and see how we got where we are. And I'll start with what it felt like when we were coming into qualifying, which started in September. And we had a full head of steam. We had beaten Mexico in the Nations League final in June, and then we'd beaten Mexico in the Gold Cup final on the 1st of August with essentially a B team. We felt we had the talent to get 9 points in September at El Salvador, at home against Canada, and at Honduras. We had our full complement of players, although Tim Weah, except for Tim Weah, who was hurt, and it wasn't even clear he was, you know, considered first choice by Berhalter. In fact, it was clear he was not considered first choice by Berhalter. So let's talk about El Salvador away. That was the opener of the whole qualifying campaign. Of course, it ended in a 0-0 draw, as you all know. And with all due respect to El Salvador, who has performed admirably, I think, given their size and where they're coming from, I think we all feel that we left 2 points on the table. It was an intense environment, just a raucous atmosphere, a packed house at the Cuscatlan, a hair-raising rendition of the Salvadoran national anthem, interspersed with and followed by the audible reports of fireworks. Gio Reyna flinched at one point while the U.S. National anthem was being played.
Yeah, this opening window was just full of like intrigue, right? And going into El Salvador, there were so many questions about how we would approach these new fangled fancy triple game windows that this cycle was throwing at us because of the pandemic. You know, it's an Ocho instead of a Hex, so you have all of these sort of floating questions. But personnel wise, I think we all felt very good about the players we had available to us. They had combined, like a 40-man combined group had taken two trophies in the summer. And it was just like, okay, how do we just get them to fit together? Because the talent's all there. We've got this.
And how do we get them to fit together is still kind of the question in a lot of ways. But some of you will remember this, but I think a lot of you won't, that the starting lineup we played against El Salvador on the road included a front three that we'll probably never see again. It was Conrad De La Fuente, Josh Sargent, and Giovanni Reyna across the front three. And I mean, we may see that again at some point, but we definitely have not seen it since for various reasons. Sargent and De La Fuente sort of falling out of favor, and then Reyna getting hurt in that first window. The rest, go ahead, Greg.
This was just a case of like right away there were sort of pre-questions of Berhalter's organization here, because a lot of us don't really think Brendan Aaronson gives us what we need in our particular setup in central midfield. And I think when the roster had been announced, there was a bit of a shortage of center midfielders named. And so I think there was a suspicion or a hope even from the fan base that Gio Reyna was going to maybe play a little bit of the central midfield role. And so when the lineup came out with the personnel it did, it still seemed like that was possible, that it was going to be Reyna, Adams, and McKenney in midfield. And then when they took the field, it was clear that Aaronson was the center midfielder, Reyna higher up in the front three. So that was already like, ah, nerds, we didn't do that. And then I don't want to say predictably, because it didn't have to go this way, but we were a little bit sloppy and we didn't quite control midfield in that game as well as I think we could have.
Yeah. It's a big contrast to how dominant we were against El Salvador, just a couple months ago. We were not dominant in this game. We had some big chances.
Yeah, I should say I should at least say El Salvador was never close to controlling the game. That was never the case. Like, it was always us who were about to control the game, and then it was just sloppy. I feel like that was the descriptor for that one. It was loose, it was sloppy, usually in midfield, but also there was a bit of sloppiness from the Sargent De La Fuente connection up higher towards the box. And that's how a game that could have gone from like full domination went to okay domination, especially if you're just talking about like the chances created. Like, we had four or five pretty good chances. El Salvador, one or two very slim, very optimistic, hopeful chances. And that's about the story of the game, I felt like.
Yeah, most of our chances came with our heads too. And I think the chance of the game, maybe the biggest chance, the biggest missed chance of the cycle, really, in my opinion, is it came in the ninth minute when Gio Reyna put a set piece on Miles Robinson's head, pretty much right at the 6-yard box line. And he sent it over the bar from point blank range. Now, I'm not going to try to be too hard on Robinson. It's not that easy of a header, but It is one he should have put on frame. And, you know, you don't think you don't like the word should there?
I really hate the word he's got to put that on frame or he's got to finish that. Those are tough. Like, it's easy to not give credit or not sort of take into account how, like, inches matter on trajectories of those things. And so, you know, if Miles might not be able to get on top of that ball as it's coming in, where he intercepts it, like he might, the only thing he might be able to do, and we saw similar from PFOC late in the game, it's hard not to get underneath it just a tiny bit while you're going up to meet it. And so it might just be that the delivery needed to be like literally 4 inches lower. And that's not because it's a bad delivery. It's just that's what needed to have happened for him to put it on frame. It's not as a gimme where he's running down over the top of it,
yeah,
and then somehow lifts it up. So I'm like, yes, it's a good chance. I was tempted when you were talking about how raucous the atmosphere was to be like, well, it didn't help him that much because we had like the best chance of the game 5 minutes in. But also maybe that's why. Maybe there were nerves involved.
It is true though. It is true. Watching the replay of it a couple times, the ball is coming from above Robinson more than I remembered it as I've been thinking about it these past few months. You're right. He wasn't coming over the top of it. His head wasn't coming down over the top of it. He was a little bit underneath it. And you know, there's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
So that's true. Good point, Greg. Fine.
I mean, you can do something, right? It just takes a lot more precision to like have it almost be like glancing, not to get so, we're already so deep into the weeds here.
Like, oh, we're going to get deeper.
Like, you have to like get the more of a glancing header rather than like the snapped head over it header. And it's just, they're difficult. They don't get converted 100% of the time.
The other big chances were McKinney with his head, Acosta with his head, and Jordan Pefok with his head. All chances to win it with their heads in the second half. El Salvador had a chance with a header from Ronald Rodriguez, that was on a corner. I would say it was probably the least of those five we've mentioned, probably the least good chance.
It looked close in practice, but it was out of all the chances difficulty wise before it came off of his head, by far the most difficult was
because he's leaning away from the goal. Right?
Yeah. He's running away. He's literally trying to like snap it to curl around to the far post, which he comes very close to doing, but that's an insanely unlikely chance to convert.
Yeah.
Notably, I think for our chances, McKinney and PFOC are two of our better finishers in the air. So if you give us these, if you say we're going to create these chances, you feel good about the fact that we've done that. So it also speaks to, again, just how much variance can play into this. It's not like, because we had PFOC, who we all know at this point, with the benefit of hindsight, just finishes chances like crazy for his club, a ton of them on headers.
Yeah.
But that's just the nature of the game, right? Like even the best probably heading finisher on the team is not an automatic goal scorer in this situation.
Yeah. We've seen that with Weston McKinney too, who is majestic in the air and hasn't always put those chances in the goal. I thought, on looking back, you know, looking back at some of our shot creation, I thought Conrad was actually a little bit useful on the left wing. You know, he created some stuff. Reyna put a peach of a ball on Weston's head for his chance in the second half. All said and done, it felt like a good learning experience. We criticized Berhalter for starting Dest at left back and sort of burning up all our right back minutes in one game. Does that still eat at you a little bit?
So at the time it was actually less about burning both our right backs in game one, cause we only brought four fullbacks to that 3-game window. It was less about that. The other two were Robinson and Bello. So two left backs we kept in reserve. It was still more about just not throwing Dest into an away match on his less favored left side for his opener of the week. Cause I didn't want to waste his fitness, his oxygen essentially in that game. But again, I don't think it wasn't inevitable that Dest was going to have a lackluster outing. He's had good outings on the road since then. It definitely did come back, turn into a roster construction issue later in the window. The fact that we trotted out both our right backs in game one.
Right. Yeah. By the time we came to the Honduras game after Dest got hurt, it was pretty thin at right back. Anyway, so let's move on to Canada at home.
My last bit on the El Salvador game, and I've said this before, is that away game to me feels like what is sort of the minimally acceptable performance level, where it's like, okay, it's unfortunate we didn't get a win. A more dominant performance would have given us even a better chance at a win, obviously. But we still controlled that game enough. We created enough where it's like, we were a little bit unlucky to leave there with 1 point instead of three.
A little bit, you know. I mean, you, on one hand, you're saying, well, these headed chances, you know, who knows if you can put them on frame. On the other hand, you're saying,
If you stack up four of those chances, okay, any one of them, you're not going to be like, oh, Miles, you know, bottled it. But you get four of those and it's like, out of the four of them, you know, you usually feel good about one of them, especially, again, given that these are decent headers of the soccer ball.
Okay. Yeah, you're stacking up like 0.65 XG on the four headers altogether.
About that. Yeah, I think well, we're so far into the depths here. But I think actually by the models, PFOX was the easiest or the most likely to score. But again, that still doesn't always take into account like the trajectory of the ball as it's meeting. It might take into account the height of the ball as it meets him, but not all of the physics involved.
Yeah, and I don't think most XG models do take into account the height, right? Do they?
Not all of them. And so, again, certainly none of them are taking into account the trajectory.
It's also like he had a defender on, like, kind of jostling him, and so did McKennie when he tried to score. Canada at home. This one was in Nashville. It ended in a 1-1 draw. It was fun to watch in the stadium, I thought, but you know, by the time I got to my computer and looked up what everybody was saying, it was clear that this was not a television experience that anybody enjoyed. The big story, of course, from that match was the day of announcement that Weston McKennie was sent home for violating COVID protocols. And we've come to learn, you know, it seems like gospel now, but back then we didn't know this for sure. We've come to learn that Weston McKennie is absolutely critical to this team, and not having him is a big problem. It's going to be a big problem in the next few weeks. So we got a lot of mileage joking about it, but it really hurt us. And you didn't joke about it. To be fair to you, I don't think you really joked about it that much, but Vince and Waki and I have spent some time joking about it.
I'm not a humorless scold. Like I get it. Like on the soccer field, not having Weston McKennie hurts us quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't know that Sebastian Legette had as bad of a game as everybody, you know, sort of on social media said he did, but it was sort of the beginning of the end of my personal support for him in the starting 11 for the national team. Cause you and I had been fans of Legette. At least I had, going back to 2019, but it was starting to, my fandom was beginning to wane at this point. What do you remember from the Canada game? Yeah.
So what I remember from the Canada game is that we very much looked like a soccer team of decent players who had never played soccer together before. And we shouldn't have looked like that, right? Pulisic, Aronson, Legette, Acosta Adams. These guys had all been around together enough, even just from the, you know, the Nations League camp. Like that's enough time to have been together for it to not have looked this drab. We basically what we did is we ran into a low block. Canada sat very low, happily conceded the ball. I think the possession percentage was like 70 to 30 at the end of the game.
It was outrageous.
And we just, what we did is we didn't attempt to break them down, which was the most frustrating thing in the world to watch on TV. Like our movement wasn't great to begin with, especially in the front three, PFOC and Aronson constantly making like the same run, always running away from the ball. It's funny because this performance ended up turning into like the next window's full emphasis on verticality, which always sounded strange to me. But what we were missing in this game was like any sort of pistoning where one of the front three is checking back and somebody else is racing behind him. So we were missing that from the front three. Our midfield three of Adams, Acosta, Legette were almost like useless at progressing the ball in this game. I'm not saying they're useless players. I think that there are real questions about all three of them as ball progressors, as putting the responsibility of progressing the ball on them has shown to be a real big risk. And in this game, again, they weren't turning the ball over, but they weren't doing anything progressive with the ball. So we were kind of relying on Serginho Dest to do some hero ball stuff out on the right side. hoping for some good service from Anthony Robinson on the left side. And we weren't getting a ton of that in meaningful ways.
Yeah. It is interesting that that whole verticality moment we had as a fan base listening to Berhalter, because I wonder if that was as much of a buzzword within the team as it was outside of the team. If it was, it is a little bit of a contrast to the clarity of John Herdman's internal presentations and this, and what seems like a lack of clarity there, or at least maybe the wrong word for what he wanted. I don't know. Because it is true. It's like we'd watch the games and you would say, I don't want people to be more vertical. Like, I don't want people running away from the ball. We need somebody coming back to the ball in this pistoning exercise.
Yeah, we were running five verts a lot in that game. It was insane that our back two, one of Miles Robinson or John Brooks would have it, or one of the midfielders, Adams Acosta or Legette, and the front five would all simultaneously just be racing away from them.
What do they call that in American football when you have everybody running a fly pattern for a Hail Mary?
That's four verts. Yeah, that's four verts. Okay. It's like a Texas Tech innovation. I don't remember. Somebody's gonna some tackle football fan's gonna jump on us for that.
Yeah, they will.
It's taken over football. Well, it doesn't work that way here. You can't just race away from the ball unless you're playing Trinidad's backups in a December friendly. Like, you have to have some kind of coordinated small group movements to unbalance the opponent. And we just didn't have any of that for the entire game.
Yeah.
Like, none of it. Our goal didn't come from unbalancing them. It came from a loose touch by Canada's central midfielder that Brendan Aaronson, of course, will pounce on because he's Brendan Aaronson and that's what he does. And then we raced forward as a unit before they could get set up in their block and score a very good counterattacking goal.
It was a nice goal. Yeah. Our best chance of the first half came on a ball floated to Legette from John Brooks. Legette brought it down, kind of cutting in towards the top of the box, did a pirouette, and then as he fell to the ground, tapped it out wide for Aaronson, who played a good low ball into the box. And Pulisic tried to bundle it in at the near post as he was falling just in front of Pifok and a Canadian center back, I forget which one, but his shot went just off the post. And I thought, you know, going back and looking at our chances, that one aside from that game, Pifok's aerial physical presence was a benefit. You know, I mean, I don't know that it is a benefit within the context of us trying to unbalance the opponent, but, you know, in what resulted, which was us just kind of trying to pump the ball in or, you know, hoping for a goal in a scramble of some kind, he's an asset. He was an asset in that way, I thought.
He was. And there were a couple of moments where, because I was going back through looking at John Brooks's distribution, of course, as he's been, you know, unceremoniously dumped from the team, or ceremoniously, very ceremoniously dumped from the team.
Medium ceremoniously.
But he had quite a few of those where it felt like we weren't getting a lot of penetrating attempts. Again, not even attempts, not just guys failing to do it, just failing to try to break their bunker down. So Brooks did take some of that responsibility on his own to try to find those gaps or those weaknesses in Canada's block. And that attempt to Legette was one. I think he had a couple to Pifok, one that Pifok tried to nod down to an on-rushing winger, another that Pifok settled backwards to a center midfielder who could then race upfield because we found them behind the block. But that was where, like, okay, this is where I was seeing there is definitely value to what John Brooks can do. At least that value is emphasized if you don't have a midfielder who can do it. So if Weston McKennie is in this game, maybe it's a different story, and he's the one who's able to push the game forward, a Luca De La Torre type, or Luca De La Torre himself, mm-hmm. could maybe do something like that, where it's about driving the game forward and putting that sort of defense on their heels kind of thing. But we weren't doing anything of that nature.
Yeah. And then, like you said, our goal came on a counterattack. Aaronson took it off of Alistair Johnston, and then he got on the end of an Anthony Robinson cross. Looked like we were, you know, back in business, qualifying, back on track. We're up 1-0. I mean, the other thing I think we should mention about the goal is there was a little bit of confusion in the middle of the field when I think everybody in Canada thought they were going to get whistled for a foul, and then the ref played advantage. And I think that little pause gave us an opening to exploit. But anyway, it was a nice cross and a nice run by Aaronson. to
get. I know we're in the time machine here, but I'm not going to let you besmirch Alistair Johnson's good name. It was Scott Kennedy. It was their other center back, like who had the giveaway. Yeah, and then he was subbed almost instantly. Herdman was not pleased, I don't think. Because, again, as long as that Canada just gave us the ball in our defensive third, we weren't dangerous. It was just about avoiding those transition moments that Scott Kennedy handed to us on a plate.
Oh, so then he was decisively subbed off, huh?
That was ceremonious.
And then Canada's danger. Canada got some danger on a counter after a Brooks giveaway and a Dest error. I'm talking about in the first half, a Brooks giveaway that led to a Larin shot that was pretty harmless. And then a Dest error on a long clearance from Borjan, where he just kind of overran the ball and Alphonso Davies cut inside him and then tried to cut it back to Larin, and Larin's shot was saved. A very nice save from Matt Turner, right?
Yeah, Turner's best save of qualifying. Basically his only good save. Not, I shouldn't say only good save, but his one Matt Turner level save of qualifying.
Whew. We're going to do an overperform, underperform segment on one of these episodes upcoming. So there's a little sneak preview of that.
That Turner save came on a sequence where it was, again, if any American fans weren't familiar with what Alphonso Davies brings, like that was it right there. Because what was normally a routine defensive track back for Serginho Dest turned into, like, the entire time it was happening, felt like, oh man, this could go wrong at any moment. And it went very wrong because of what Alphonso Davies can do.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll push back a little bit on that. Yes, Alphonso Davies makes it more nerve-wracking, but that is a play that Serginho Dest can deal with. I mean, he's more nervous because of who's behind him, I'm sure, but he made a meal out of that.
he definitely did. It's something where, like, in retrospect, maybe he just, you know, fires that ball into the 20th row to deal with Davies. Yeah. But because he's trying to possess it, where normally in that situation he would be able to, like, maintain possession for the team, it becomes a really risky thing to do with Alphonso Davies breathing down your neck.
You know, something I just realized today that I didn't know before this was Canada had drawn Honduras at home in the previous game. So they weren't, you know, they weren't flying into Nashville full of confidence the way they were when we played them in Hamilton in February. But
no, and then they drew their third game too. They had three straight draws to open the. Do yeah. I have that right? I thought they opened their qualifying campaign with three draws. Yeah.
Then there, of course, their goal came on a pretty straightforward attack. Adekugbe plays it down the left wing to Davies, who beats Yedlin. Yedlin had come on for Dest, who got hurt early in the game, and he just Yedlin can never get back in front of Davies, and he squares it in front of the goal for Kyle Larin, who John Brooks had stopped tracking. I mean, he was tracking him at one point, or at least was tracking adjacent, but he didn't track him at the end, and Larin had a tap in front of the goal.
So people have been saying this is like John Brooks fell asleep or anything else. And I promise this isn't like to try to defend John Brooks. I don't think that what he does here is like the right play necessarily. But what it looks like to me in the rewatch is that he's essentially trying to fill a lane. Like as Davies rounds Yedlin to get the edge, Miles and Brooks are both tracking back, you know, to fill the middle. And it looks like what Brooks is trying to do is, you know, you've the bowling lanes that Davies can feed this ball across in are limited. And so it looks like he's thinking that Turner has the, you know, the goal mouth bowling lane. Mm-hmm. Miles Robin has the next lane up. And so Brooks is going to occupy the third lane for a cutback at more of an angle. And it just so happens that Miles and Turner do not have an overlapping coverage shadow. And Davies hits the ball into that gap. And it's an easy tap in for Kyle Larin. Well, again, I'm not saying that's even the right choice. I'm just saying it looks to me like it's a conscious choice by John Brooks and not just like he fell asleep and didn't track his man.
So maybe Robinson deserves a little blame for not covering his bowling lane better.
Probably not. Like I'd still probably put it on Brooks to recognize that that lane won't get covered. Cause Robinson can't see everything behind him. He's got to focus on, Alphonso Davies. It's more just about like, it's really hard to coordinate in these moments, right? This is why so much of the modern game is about denying these chaotic AVPs, if we're going to use Canada's parlance, in the first place. And it's like, Yedlin needs to drag Alphonso Davies down 40 yards from goal if he can, so that this doesn't happen. Because making these decisions on the fly and getting them all correct all together, all the players acting in coordinated fashion, very difficult.
Yeah. Well, we're 30 minutes in and we've only gotten through the first two games of 11 we need to cover. So
we could make this a two part edition.
Okay. I mean, let's just keep going and see what happens.
All right.
So at the, you know, at the end of this game, it didn't look like we didn't really threaten after Canada equalized, not in any serious way. And it kind of felt like we weren't up for it. We weren't up for World Cup qualifying. Now you look back, those were not ridiculously bad results, but they were both games where we could have gotten 3 points and didn't. And it hurts us. I think it hurts us in our current situation, probably more than anything except for that Panama loss.
So I'll give that the El Salvador game, you know, felt like points on the table. The Canada game for me felt more like just a continuation of the attacking struggles we'd been seeing since the summer windows, since the Switzerland friendly through all the way through the Gold Cup. So despite lifting two trophies, like at no point did it feel like our attack was humming. You know what I mean? Like that we were never firing on all cylinders. So the Canada game was just like, we had very good players in that game. We have Pulisic, we have Aronson. We feel like, you know, a full complement of guys who won trophies against Mexico. And it's like, nope, it didn't matter. The attack is not solved. We have not figured out how to actually play a fluid style of soccer that disorganizes the opponent with the ball. It's not a thing we do.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's not. So maybe we didn't leave points on the table. We just got the exact amount of points we deserved.
for Canada, for sure. The El Salvador one, I'll give you that. It was like, that felt like a 3 point game that we only got 1 point from.
I guess I just think we should have had something of a more attacking rhythm at that point in Berhalter's tenure than we did.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
In that sense, we left points on the table.
I very much agree that, like, that, again, it felt like we went into that game and looked like a team that had never played before. And I very much think that that's like a big part of that is how we prepared, how we used the time going all the way back from Cuba, the time that we were eliminated, to this first opening World Cup qualifying window, which is all of the focus was on. The entire project is building to this performance. And just being that sort of inept.
Oh, wait. What are we going to do? They're in a low block. You know, what are we going to do?
Again, when the stated goal of the coach in his opening press conference is about disorganizing the opponent with the ball, like that's his focus. And then to go into this, you know, the very first test of it and just being looking completely unready to deal with it in any capacity.
Yeah.
That was the giant frustration from Canada.
It was very frustrating. It's frustrating even to people like John Mueller who don't get nearly as emotional as say I do about this stuff.
He's so amused by all of it and by all of us.
But he thought that was that was a disaster to watch. The Canada game in particular.
That does almost give you like comfort, doesn't it? When even somebody is sort of detached from it all, it's like, oh, that was bad. What are we doing? No one knows what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I was in the stadium. I was just kind of enjoying the night, having a great time. And, but you know, when you sit and watch it on TV with fewer beers in your body, you do have to admit that that was pretty bad. All right.
Well, Bells, you're making a very good case that is just the correct way to enjoy the U.S. men's national team.
Just to sit there with friends.
Just hang out, watch it with friends. Yeah. Do not rewatch the game 6 times. Do not isolate one player's clips and watch those 3 times.
And honestly, that's, you know, most people don't do that stuff. It's just a few of us. Honduras away. So the 9-point window talk was totally gone at this point, and we looked pretty bad in the first half against Honduras in San Pedro Sula, a place where I was scared to play at. I remember how we played there in 2017. That was probably the worst game of the qualifying cycle. We got bailed out by a Bobby Wood goal late to get a 1-1 draw. But we came out in a 3-4-3 with McKenzie, Brooks, and Robinson on the back line. Again, McKenny was gone. He was temporarily banished from the team. What do you remember?
So I remember right away being like, James Sands probably doesn't make sense in midfield too. The poor guy. I don't love once I actually saw that it was Kellen Acosta in the midfield with him and Tyler Adams at right back. I wasn't thrilled about that. Again, this goes back to us burning through our right backs so that we have Tyler Adams who can play a game, but we can't put him in the middle of the park. We have to put him on the side, because if it's a 3-4-3 with Adams and Acosta instead of Sands, like that could literally change the entire narrative of the 3-4-3 formation for the U.S. Like right now it's now totally associated with that first half disaster against Honduras. And if we had just had, I don't care, any Brooks Lennon, Aaron Herrera, any right back who was within a plane trip to this soccer field, like it could have just looked fine. Adams and Acosta as the two in that might have just made the total difference, and we could have totally controlled the game, leaned on Honduras enough to get the goals that eventually came. And we would all think of the 3-4-3 as a fantastic variation of personnel that we can use. Instead, like, we had to flush it within 45 minutes because it was a disaster.
Yeah, it really was. It felt so shambolic because, I mean, Adams was playing wing back and then Bello was on the other side at wing back. And we gave up a goal that, you know, I mean, it was a pretty even first half for the most part, at least until the goal. And then we had a kind of a sloppy giveaway from Sargent and Sands near midfield, and then a 2-minute period of chaos. And then Rubio from Honduras skips by Brooks in zone 14 and slips it to Jonathan Toro wide left. And then he crosses it for Brian Moya, whose diving header beats Turner in the 27th minute. So Moya was wide open. George Bello, I think we've been over this. He was not responsible enough to pick up Moya, even though he had a play in front of him. Just didn't really recognize the moment at all. It didn't look like on the replay.
Right, right. We had the numbers available to defend even after Brooks gets beat, stepping up, and we just absolutely, like, Bello in particular just does not go into the space that it's very obvious he needs to go into to protect the goal.
Right. And now we're looking at, so we're down 1-0. The second half of the first half was a dark time because it really was. Because it's like, what are we doing? Tyler Adams at right wing back, and we're gonna get 2 points from this window.
We haven't even mentioned that Ricardo Pepi, 17-year-old wonder kid, has gotten his very first national team start of any kind, appearance of any kind, on the road in what essentially felt like a must-win World Cup qualifier.
And Josh Sargent was playing right wing, Pulisic at left wing. I mean, I don't even remember Pulisic doing anything in that first half. Sargent was not super sharp either. I don't think Pepi was really that sharp in the first half.
No, everyone looked late to do anything. Anything that they try to do, whether it was on the attacking side or the defensive side, they always looked late to doing it. Like, they were trying to figure out what to do, and then once they made the decision, it was usually too late to execute it in any way that gave us any kind of an advantage.
But to Berhalter's credit, he must have said some good things at the half, and he made three subs. Aronson came on for Sargent, Anthony Robinson came on for George Bello, and Sebastian Legette came on for Brooks to switch it back to a regular 4-3-3. So McKenzie and Robinson became the two center backs in a four-man back line. And then things started going our way. We had that well-taken right-footed goal from Anthony Robinson after a Legette cross skipped through Pepi and a defender. And then Pepi scored on that towering header on a Yedlin cross. And the goal call from Andres Cordero, Pepi by name, Pepi by nature, is not my favorite, but but whatever.
And it's burdened your brain, right? Because that was a huge moment.
That was a huge moment. And you watch the replay and you keep having to hear Pepi by nature. And I'm like, no, man. But that's okay. And then we just rolled them from then on. Aronson and Legette each added a goal, and the Honduras fans were olaying their own team. And it turns out Honduras is not very good, was not very good, is not very good. That this game could have gone a different way is a terrifying thought, but it didn't. So we won 4-1, and we ended the window with 5 points, which, you know, considering what happened in the first two games, is not too bad.
Well, yeah, it's as good as it could possibly have been after the first two games.
No, let me break it down for you.
And it was, again, it was the end of the window then. That actually was, for me, like a roller coaster window. But by the end of it, it finished with us just squandering like a little bit of cushion. Because as we've talked about, the win at home, draw on the road thing works if that's what you do the entire cycle. But there's like some really tough road games that you probably aren't expecting yourself to draw as much as you hope to be optimistic. And so getting those wins at the weaker teams venues like El Salvador becomes kind of important. So the fact that we ended up on par, given that we played two of the weaker teams in the Ocho, felt like, okay, we squandered a little bit of cushion. We have a ton of built-in cushion to qualify. We've just used a little bit of that up.
Yeah. And, you know, an elite soccer nation or even a you know, who's kind of a mid-tier good soccer nation?
Like Germany, for example.
No, I don't think so. Switzerland or somebody, they would go and beat El Salvador on the road, you know?
Well, I threw Germany out there because I think everyone points to the German loss to North Macedonia. And that might have even been in Germany. As like, look, it can happen to everyone. But then like they never like follow it up by saying Germany went 9 wins, 1 loss in their World Cup qualifying campaign when they lost to North Macedonia. It's like, yes, you can have these hiccups. You can't have a hiccup every road game. Like that starts to be the problem.
Yeah, we've had a lot of road hiccups for sure. All right. Let's do some announcements.
Where are we at on time, Bells? Can we get through
40? We're at 43 minutes. So
one window in. I'm not going to do the math on this, speaking of maintaining pace, but
well, I think we may not have to spend as much time on every window, although the next two are going to require a lot of discussion. So let's just see what happens. Some announcements before we get to the October window. We're going to blow it out in Orlando on the 27th. Five-a-side pickup soccer the morning of the Panama match, a short distance from the stadium, and then a big tailgate all afternoon, even closer to the stadium. We're calling the five-a-side pickup soccer the Greg Velasquez Five-a-Side Tournament of Roses. Greg Velasquez Memorial Five-a-Side Tournament of Roses, even though you are obviously still living.
I think my understanding was it's in regard to my Achilles heels, both of which are destroyed and then repaired. So it's in memoriam of my original Achilles heels.
The Greg Velasquez Achilles Memorial.
If you couldn't tell, that was me working in like preemptive excuses for whatever my five-a-side performance will look like.
You're not the only one. The excuses are flowing like water these days. Tactical manager was talking about his knees. Goodness gracious. No, I'm sure he has a real knee problem. He says he's had 3 surgeries in the last 3 years, so.
Everyone's going to be showing up with x-rays. Everyone's showing up with their x-rays and MRIs.
And then number two, I know I say this all the time, but I got to do it. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. We are ad-free and we make money from people's voluntary monthly pledges. A couple of perks you get for being a patron are the Monday reviews with Vince and Waki, which are patron only most of the time, and then access to the Discord. I know a lot of you don't know what that means. So MCB puts it like this. MCB on the Discord, a person on the Discord, says it's like joining the scuffed group chat without having to give anyone your phone number. And it is a nice place to chat live with knowledgeable fans, you know, basically whenever anything USMNT related is going on, including a US player playing anywhere. Okay, the October window. Let's just plow ahead and see what happens. Next, we had Jamaica home, Panama away, and Costa Rica at home. No Pulisic in this window. Reyna's still out, of course. I thought, you know, if the Honduras game was Pepe's coming out party, because he was involved in all four of those goals in one way or another, the game against Jamaica felt like his coronation as a striker for the national team. He scored 2 goals, I mean, I'm not speaking for the nerds here. The nerds might not have thought he was the striker, but I'm speaking for the everyman, Greg. Jamaica was without Mikael Antonio and pretty toothless. And we got goals from Pepe on assists from Dest and Aronson. I thought particularly the goal on the Dest assist was very nice. A much more difficult finish than it looked like initially, kind of leaning back like we talked about earlier. And we won 2-0. I think you should give a couple thoughts on this, and we should just move quickly on to the Panama game.
All right. The thing I liked about this game was because Canada was so dire in our attempts to actually play good flowing soccer, the Jamaica game was halting. It was clumsy, but we were trying. Like, you could see there was this pistoning action despite all the talk being about verticality. There was very much like a balanced motion, like a choreography between forward and winger or winger and midfielder. And so there was a lot more of that. Tim Weah coming in off the bench, Paul Arriola, Brendan Aronson as sort of our wingers in that Jamaica game. They were all eager to like come back into the half space, more like those half space merchants we'd grown accustomed to allow players to run in behind them while we connected into those pockets. And so that for me was like the most promising thing about this game. It wasn't always very clean, but you could tell we were trying it from the off, and it paid off. I think it was still 0-0 at half, right? Second half, like the payoff was there and it was always coming.
Yeah. Very good. We have to move on quickly. Panama away. This was, I think we should, one other thing we should mention about Jamaica is that was, I think that was that Zimmerman's first start of the
first appearance? He didn't play in the first three games. First window, Zimmerman did not appear. We brought six center backs, if you include James Sands, and Zimmerman was the only one who did not play in the first window.
Okay. What a turnabout it's been for him. Any other lineup notes? Paul Arriola did start that game at right wing.
Ahead of Tim Weah.
Pretty well. Tim Weah came in off the bench.
So, yeah, so that was the other most notable thing for me there is Tim Weah came off the bench and was lightning. To be fair, Giazzi Zardoz also came off the bench and also had a ton of influence. So this is going to sound like a dig at Zardoz now, but I don't mean it that way. Part of that is like those games at the end can start to just get like that, where attacking players can just have their way. Weah definitely did that. Like, he looked incredible, dangerous every time he got the ball. And I was like, oh, man, this is the kind of attacking third polish that we don't get from Paul Arriola. But maybe it's just because, you know, Jamaica have checked out of a 0-2 soccer game.
Yeah. Okay. Panama was the nadir of the qualifying campaign so far. You know, there's a decent shot for the second half of the first half against Honduras, but that was corrected quickly. So we mustered five shots on goal, and two of those were in the first four minutes. Arriola had a shot blocked off his foot, basically, and Zimmerman leaned away and headed a set piece over the bar. So in this game, we had Arriola starting again at right wing, Tim Weah at left wing, Giazzi Zardoz at striker, and then we had the famous Kellen Acosta, Sebastian Legette, Yunus Musa midfield. I can't remember exactly why McKennie wasn't in this game. Was it because of yellow card suspension?
No, he did not travel. So McKennie and Anthony Robinson did not travel to Panama, and it was said that they just had minor injuries, or at least McKennie did. Anthony might have been like a English prohibition on him traveling. I know we had our time machine off to get back into it, but neither McKennie nor Robinson were at the field.
Yeah. And then we, you know, speaking of time machines, we had Shaq Moore at right back and George Bello at left back. And this was George Bello's last appearance of the qualifying campaign. It's also Shaq Moore's, I believe.
Correct.
So this game ended a lot of people's qualifying campaigns. Three, actually. And it might be McKenzie's last appearance, too.
Yes, it is. And then Matt Turner was benched after this game. I know he's gotten back in due to injuries, but he also saw this game run his minutes down.
We don't need to get all into the details, I don't think, but you know, it was a feckless outing from the Americans, like I said in the recap. And Panama's goal came. Now, Panama wasn't amazing or anything. I think they were the better team on the night, and probably deserved to win. Their goal came on a Jazzy Zardes own goal. Tell us what you remember from the game before I get into my Zardes own goal bit here.
So it was another game of players just not attempting to move the ball forward or being totally unable to as a team because of, team relationship positioning. So this is one where, like, I'm basically giving I give the entire front three, Jazzy Zardes included, like a total pass on their lack of involvement. The issue was very much goalkeeper, backline, central midfielders, and just, again, a complete inability / unwillingness. It was both in this game. Leggett just seemed unwilling to try to go forward. Everyone else just seemed unable to go forward. And it was just a complete mess. Panama offered almost nothing going back at us, despite, like, us being so bad. And so my big takeaway was just kind of like a real joy, actually, in watching Panama protecting their 1-0 lead. And I mean that, like, as much as I love the United States men's national team, watching the underdog do what Panama did to us for the last 30 minutes of that game was like a real pleasure.
Yeah, you're talking about like pitch invaders and ball boys throwing balls on the field at the wrong times and stuff.
Right, scripted pitch invaders. Like, it was amazing how good they were and how willing they were to just destroy the clock for 30 minutes. So that's the other thing to keep in mind, too, when you talk about, you know, Panama didn't do too much. They also stopped trying to play soccer after that goal, and it was very much just a shenanigans exercise in clock killing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Max and Montana, who's in the Discord and is like a capo for American Outlaws, he was there and he said it was one of the coolest things he's ever seen. You know, he's like a big U.S. fan.
I have to respect that. Like, again, because we have such a built-in advantage over certain teams, like, when I see them doing that to, like, get that edge to level things, I just have to respect it. I really enjoy it.
It should be mentioned, Kellen Acosta had a really bad game, too. He escapes some of the criticism because he's had other good performances, including, you know, in St. Paul a few weeks ago. But he had a shocker of just like poor touches and not up for that game.
Now it was Acosta Leggett. It was the fullbacks in my mind, and that was more of a positioning issue, both pressing and being releases for us in possession. And then this was another one where it was also Berhalter. So those are sort of the combination of failures in my mind that lead to this being a 0-1 game instead of either 1-1 or 0-0.
And as many have pointed out, Berhalter did not sub out Leggett or Acosta, at least not until very late, if at all. I can't remember.
No, they played 90 minutes. Yeah. So Luca De La Torre on the bench in that game, unused. Gianluca Buzio unused. So those three guys played the whole. Adams came on at halftime for Yunus Musa, and that was probably more of a minutes management thing rather than Musa struggling. But we left Leggett and Acosta on, and again, you saw those guys' minutes crater. George Bello canned, and this is where I talk about sort of the difference between how it just works in sports, right? The players who have the poor outings, you can drop them, you can replace them. The coach has the poor outing, and it's like, okay, well, we just have to hope Berhalter learns better game management.
Yeah. Now, on the Zardes own goal, I always just considered it a sort of a this is how the cookie crumbles kind of situation, and perhaps a lack of box control from Turner. Until I listened to Eric Winalda's podcast at the suggestion, which I don't usually do, but I listened to this one episode at the suggestion of Patrick Keeler and More Buildings and Food on the Discord. And I did find it sort of persuasive. Winalda's very critical of the positioning of both Zardes and Leggett. They're both too far away from their own, that near post, and which causes them. So Leggett's kind of, you know, the ball goes over Leggett. I don't know that it's really that big of a deal what he does or doesn't do here. But what Zardes does is he's leaning toward his own goal to try to head it away. And Winalda's saying that that's a big no-no. You shouldn't try to do that. And he also thought that we just weren't prepared for that set piece. Like, we didn't have the details nailed down as a team, and he criticized Berhalter for that, and I found it kind of persuasive.
I'll give that to Winalda on Zardes. It's a tough one. Like, it's, you see players head the ball over their own crossbar at times.
Yeah.
And Zardes is not a bad header. Zardes is actually a pretty good header of the soccer ball. That's one of his very, like, that's for him, that's one of his strong points. So at some point you need to defer to the player to make a play. I agree on the legit point. Like, you don't need to be any closer to the ball than Panama's closest player. So legit, you know, I mean, you can essentially like reverse or post the guy up, if that makes sense, between the ball and the man is what legit can be doing. And instead he's 2 yards closer to the ball. So you talk about pitch control. That is just forfeiting pitch control for no reason.
Yeah.
You with me on that?
Kinda, yeah.
Like it gives the ball deliverer a chance to put it over your head to the attacking player. If you're right on the guy, then it reduces the window for that ball to be played.
Okay. So you're not you don't totally buy this idea that Zardes shouldn't have tried to get his head on it.
I don't buy that. I think if Zardes doesn't try to make a play on that ball, then he's just going to say me making zero play is better than is preferable, like, or is me making a play, trying to make a play is worse than just letting this Panama player have a free header from 2 yards out. And I know the outcome is, yeah, well, you should have let him do it, but I don't think you judge it on the outcome there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm really just caught between Eric Winalda and Greg Velasquez, and I don't even know what to do.
Reminder to everyone, Panama had tried this like 4 times in the first half, so we had a good sense of where they were going. So the idea that Zardes is set up too far away from the goal line, Legette set up too far away from that man on the near post, I think those are both fair. You're essentially saying any ball between our back line and the goal is Matt Turner's ball. And I don't think there was any way Turner can get to this. So I would say this is like a failure in setup.
I also do wonder if, you know, Zardes just letting it fly past him would have resulted in a free header for Anibal Godoy or somebody else. It might have been
there were two guys. There was Godoy and then another man right behind him. No other U.S. player close to it. So if Zardes lets this go, he's going to get pilloried for that too, in my mind.
Okay.
Like, make a play, you know, like, you got to do something.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm back to cookie crumbles. Costa Rica at home. Of course, we won 2-1 and got the 3 points, but this game had some real wrinkles to it. First of all, Tim Weah was going to be on the bench for this one if it weren't for an injury to Paul Arriola. So we get the lineup, you know, minutes before the game, an hour before the game, and it's Paul Arriola in the starting lineup. And then all of a sudden, no, it's going to be Tim Weah. And then second of all, we'll get into that more. And then second of all, we gave up a weird early goal and went down 1-0, which was very disconcerting. Because we're all riding pretty low after the Panama game.
Exactly. So that one, another one of those cookie crumbling goals where it's just like, oh, man. 7 people in a row made tiny little mistakes and the ball ends up in our goal.
Yeah. Yeah. We did not, you did not blame Stefan for letting that past him. I thought that was discriminating and charitable of you. Charitable is not the right word. It was discriminating. But the thing about Weah not being in the plans to start and then getting to start at the last minute is he was the best player on the field. And it does call into question Berhalter's judgment a little bit. Don't you think?
Yeah, I don't think there's any way around that. It gave, like, the fact that Ariel was in gave the Weah believers time to like complain that he was left out. It gave the Arriola defenders time to say, no, everyone just doesn't appreciate what Arriola brings to the table. And so then we kind of got the actual science experiment here of like, maybe Tim Weah really is ready to do this. And I think the evidence comes in on the side of Tim Weah was really ready to do that.
But we're talking 6 games into World Cup qualifying.
Yes, we are. But let's focus on Tim Weah and how good he is. Can we do that? Or do you want to... Do you want to have it still be?
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, just his ability to interpret space, you know, all this talk about like whether or not Berhalter's system is too complex or whatever, people take forever to learn it. Like, Weah does not have that much time in Berhalter camps. He's been injured for so long while Berhalter's been in charge. He's got incredibly limited minutes. He comes in and it just he makes it look like the system was built for him. Like, it looks like everything that we do has been keyed to Tim Weah. And so very clearly, it is possible to jump into this system and play into this team and play with sort of that freedom and that fluidity. And it's just like eye opening and sort of tells you, kind of gives us that hint of what might be possible for the U.S.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't do this with Lille. I mean, he's fine with Lille, but like he goes several weeks in a row without even playing for them. He's not like the key piece to Lille at this point. And no. Lille are a mid-table team in the French league. So, you know, it still just gets back to that thing of like, we can take a good player and he can do it on the international level.
Yeah. Well, he does fit so well because he is so good off the ball. And makes such
and big, on the ball.
Yeah. I mean, he's good on the ball at some things. Like he's good at making fast, incisive decisions. He's good at putting the ball across, he's good at cutting it back. He's good at like you always talk about, he's good at getting a little window to get that pass away.
He's shown even in the at least at the CONCACAF level, an ability too to like disguise like a shoulder drop. As the ball's coming to him, he always does that kind of thing. Like he's always doing something to give himself an edge. But these little shoulder feints he's been doing for the national team in these qualifiers have actually been like eliminating the first defender, not just opening a window up. But he's had plenty of times where he is totally like ethered a defender and then is able to run at the next defender up. And that's when he'll make his like pass.
Mm.
So that's been like another positive that, you know, I've always been high on Weah. I didn't even think he was going to be doing it to this level. So it's just been, man, has it been fun watching him play.
It sure like, has.
Minute for minute, I think he has been by far our most consistent performer through qualifying.
Really? More than McKennie?
More than McKennie. That might be tough, but like what he has been doing has been, I think, more decisive for outcomes, frankly. Like I think he has been doing the extremely hard work of creating goals.
Yeah, no doubt
McKennie
about that.
McKennie does a ton of stuff to like tip the field in our favor. And then Weah has been doing the things that last cycle Christian Pulisic was doing for us and that we were hoping Christian Pulisic would be doing for us this cycle, but we haven't been getting it. And if Weah weren't doing this, like, I don't know what this would, what the standings would look like.
Yeah. We'd be, I mean, probably you have to assume goals would have come from somewhere, but
hopefully,
I can't figure out where they would have come from.
Without Reyna, I mean, yeah, it's just been incredible what Weah has just jumped right in and accomplished for me. Maybe people think I'm over penduluming, but I've just been so impressed with what he's done. I was ready to be impressed, to be fair, but
yeah, you've always been a big Weah guy. The goal, the first goal for the U.S., you know, we're down 1-0, but we're playing pretty well. It comes on that Dest banger. I don't need to go through the play-by-play of it. You guys remember. But it's a really, really good, really, really good shot from Dest. And then Lionel Moreira comes on for Keylor Navas at the half for Costa Rica. Navas leaves with a muscle injury. So this is another wrinkle. Wrinkle number three or four, I can't remember, is that Ruiz breakaway where he steals the ball.
At 1-1, right?
Yeah, at 1-1. He's very clever to hide behind Tyler Adams and anticipate Miles Robinson's pass to Richards. He picks it off, and then he's just away. Robinson does manage to reel him in, but only because he's 97 years old.
I was going to say, what was really clever was Brian Ruiz playing a five-year long con of being really slow and old to trick us into this one moment where he bursts forward onto Miles Robinson's casual pass.
So wily. But yeah, Robinson does track him down and they doesn't even get a shot off. And then we get the goal for the U.S. It's call it wrinkle number five. I mean, it's a frankly poor diagonal ball from Weston McKennie that is just massively mishandled by Keisha Fuller. And it falls to Dest, who takes a touch and then plays Weah in behind. And Weah takes a shot that kind of hammers off the near post and then Moreira and then goes in barely. And it's scored as an own goal, but it's a good shot from Weah. and we won 2-1. But not, you know, not was not a comfortable victory, I wouldn't say.
No one goal game can be comfortable in World Cup qualifying, right? Because of, again, the nature of soccer and how the tiniest flicker of a chance at goal can turn into one sometimes, and several outstanding chances can be denied sometimes. So you're never comfortable at that point, you know, as a fan. But as far as the performance went, I was extremely happy with the performance even before our first goal, even before the Des Banger. Like I felt like we were kind of like cooking. And it was like a continuation of the home Jamaica game, which makes sense because it was more of the same players rather than the rotated Panama side. Mm-hmm. It's at home. You add Tim Weah's polish. I thought we were doing it.
It was our best performance of qualifying easily up to that point. And it did give us hope that the disorganizing with the ball with the opponent was going to come to fruition.
I thought it was our best like attacking performance of the Greg Berhalter era. Like since he's been in charge, I don't think we have ever looked nearly as fluid as we looked in that game. And that was a combination. Again, a ton of it is Tim Weah. It was Weah playing with Dest and Musa on that right side. McKennie getting in on the act. Weah and Aronson being willing to like flip sides or be on the same side at the same time. And again, this is where I talk about, it's not like Greg Berhalter's possession system is not so rigid that these players don't do these things, right? Tim Weah and Brennan Aronson suddenly both occupying the left sideline. Like that's not like prescribed in the system. That's just good players reading the game well and doing things that disorganize Costa Rica in this case.
Yeah. Okay. So at this point in qualifying, we sat second in the table behind Mexico. We'd probably underperformed a little bit, particularly the loss to Panama and the draw at El Salvador. But other than that Costa Rica match, the bigger issue for me was we hadn't been very convincing. So I guess it's good that the convincing attacking performance, and I guess I'm not quite as high on it as you are.
I was pretty high. Well, but, I was high on it relative to what we had looked like for 2.5 years up to that point. Because, okay. Like, I don't know if you remember, it was our crossover with the TSS folks where it was like, can we ever play good soccer? And I think a lot of people had effectively like given up. Like, no, we just have to accept that good soccer is beyond us. And I was still holding out like, no. Like we can do this. Guys can make good movements and interact and interchange and combine. Like this is not some impossible Gordian knot. Like this can happen. So I was really excited to see us like do some of those things, even if it's not the highest level, to show that like you can make immediate progress. It doesn't have to be a 3-year turnaround time.
Well, it did have to be a 3-year turnaround time.
It ended up being a 3-year turnaround time. It didn't have to be a 3-year turnaround time.
All right. Well, we're well over an hour into this, so we better break it into two parts. We better. We're gonna come back with part two on the November and January/February windows. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you.